This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to sex and the internet, the news headlines aren't the half of it these days. The Department of Homeland Security official arrested this week for soliciting what he thought was a 14-year-old girl online. The California teenage boy who made hundreds of thousands of dollars performing sexually on the web. The real story is much larger. A world, a nation, now awash in 24/7 hardcore sex. Always there, always on. Shaping young minds, messing with marriages, moving sex from the bedroom to the pale glow of the computer screen. Up next on Point, sex and the internet, the unprecedented ocean of porn and possibilities now at our fingertips, and how it's affecting lives and society. Later in this hour, we'll hear from the president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers on the role of internet pornography and hard drives now playing in divorce court. But first, joining me from New York is Pamela Paul. She's contributing writer to Time magazine and author of Pornified, How Pornography is Transforming Our Lives, Our Relationships, and Our Families. Pamela Paul, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
You've looked at pornography very broadly, but of course, the internet is the pornography ocean now. What's your big takeaway? What's the impact?
Well, the internet has really transformed not only the way in which people look at pornography, but who's looking at pornography, how often they're looking at it, and the kind of pornography that they're looking at. And essentially what the internet has done to pornography is really opened it up and broadened it and deepened it. So what you have is you have people looking at pornography at a younger age. You have casual users, guys who, 20 years ago, maybe they would have picked up a copy of Playboy or mm-hmm. Penthouse or Hustler on the newsstand every once in a while or even subscribed. They're now looking at pornography every day, often for 40 minutes a day or, at least 3 or 4 times a week. So they're looking at pornography a lot more often than they would have. They're looking at it at work, every morning. They're looking at it at night. They have total access to it, and pornography is completely anonymous. You don't have to go down in order to watch, to see a movie to a seedy side of town to some adult theater. You can just click, on your computer or on satellite television and have pornography right there at your fingertips. So it's really changed who's looking at pornography, how often they're looking at it. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is with pornography in magazines, you used to be able to choose softcore porn or hardcore porn. If you wanted mm-hmm. to just look at naked women, you would look at Playboy. But now hardcore and softcore are very intermingled online. So if you go on and you're just wanting to look at still photos of naked women, a couple of clicks away, you're at very hardcore videos of actual sex acts.
You name it.
And right.
Mm-hmm. And that's of course, is just the beginning in a way. I mean, that ocean of porn that sits there all the time, there's also the chat rooms and the whole kind of sexual environment. It can and does go over into the prosecutable, and we'll talk with a prosecutor about when things become illegal. But Pamela Paul, people talk about the internet porn's accessibility, affordability, and anonymity really changing things. Porn is as old as the moon, but here it's all over the place. What's the impact when people are, you surveyed a lot of people, you found how often people, men in particular, but also women and kids are touching this. What's the impact on our minds, on the way we look at each other, the way we look at sex?
Well, let's look at men, because obviously, as you said, they're the primary consumer. Mm. The way in which men look at porn online has really changed the way that they think about pornography. And the way, it's interesting, most of the men I talked to were casual users of pornography. These were men who were very happy with porn. They loved it. They didn't have a problem with it. And yet they told me that porn had begun to sort of filter in to their sex lives, to their personal lives, to the way in which they thought about women. So, for example, men told me that they were having trouble achieving orgasm, with sex with a real woman alone. Many men felt that they had to either watch pornography while they were having sex with a woman, or they needed to conjure up images from pornography in order to maintain their level of interest and excitement. Other men told me that, sort of flip side, they would be having sex with their wife or their girlfriend or whoever, and really wanting to focus in on that person, but that images from pornography would sort of seep into their mind, like a, you know, like a song you'd get into your head. It's not even, you know, you don't even necessarily like the song, but it just becomes, it just sort of enters into your mind. And it makes sense because, you know, obviously if you're masturbating to something regularly, then you begin to associate that particular image with sexual release, and then it becomes hard to disassociate it.
And is this the weird, rare exception, or is this now getting into kind of the mainstream American male sexual profile?
You know, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, you must have just talked to, you know, perverts or, you know, sexual oddities or people, you know, who are, you know, holed up in their room all day with pornography. The men I talked to were a very diverse group of guys. I talked to, you know, Ivy League bankers types. I talked to artists, graphic designers, people who were in the military. It was a very wide range of people. There wasn't really a way to sort of define them. Some of them were in committed relationships. Some of them were single. Some of them were dating. They looked at pornography for different reasons. But what I think has become increasingly common is that this negative side of pornography has shown up. Because, again, if you're looking at a magazine, you know, once or twice a month, that's very different from looking at something 40 minutes a day. And also,
40 minutes a day, though, do you have any sense of, is that common? Is that rare? 40 minutes a day is a lot of time to spend looking at naked pictures and sex online, isn't it?
It is. What's interesting is that it's very hard to track this. There are a couple of internet firms that that monitor usage of what they call adult websites. But the problem is, and they will admit this, they capture a very small part of that universe. So what they found is something like, you know, for example, 70% of 18 to 34-year-olds look at pornography online.
That's a pretty high percentage. That's a pretty high percentage. And we're not saying 70%, 40 minutes every day, but it's easy to go there. It's always there. And there you've got the pornified man in your term. What about the pornified woman? What's the impact for the woman, whether she's looking at it or in a relationship with a man who is? How's that work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. First of all, I would say that the usage by women is grossly overestimated. It's a very sexy story. You know, women are into porn. It's obviously something the industry would very much like because they look out at the market and, you know, 50% penetration. You know, they have this huge opportunity out there. So, and I think they're doing a very good job of converting women over, certainly. But the majority of usership is still men. So for women, it's often about being in a relationship with a guy who's looking at pornography or being out on the dating scene. And knowing that every guy, as a lot of women in their 20s put it, every guy they know, they would say, looks at online porn and not only thinks it's okay, but thinks it's funny, thinks that, you know, women should be okay with it, that if a woman dares protest, that she's a prude, she's a reactionary, she's uptight, she's anti-sex. And, you know, it extends into the real world. There was one woman who I call Ashley in the book, a 24-year-old from Baltimore, whose live-in boyfriend goes to a strip club every month and gets a lap dance. And she said, you know, if you were sitting here on our couch getting that lap dance, that would be considered cheating. Why is it okay if it's in a strip club?
Of course, the web brings almost everything but the lap dance right into the home or can. What about for children, for kids, Pamela Paul?
It's scary because, again, I think a lot of parents today of children that age, they're baby boomers, and they associate porn with, you know, the 60s sexual liberation, women's movement, Hugh Hefner, the sort of wink, wink, you know, it has a very positive image for a lot of these parents. And many of them, especially mothers, have not actually gone online and looked and seen what it is that their kids have access to. So we're talking about, you know, where once a boy would come across pornography, you know, at summer camp, he'd be 10 or 11 years old or 12 and see a copy passed around, or an older brother would give him a copy of a magazine. We're talking about 8, 9, 10-year-old boys and girls coming across things that aren't just nudity online, but, you know, very hardcore scenes of multiple penetration. I don't know how much detail you want
there.
Me to go
well,
into
I mean, just,
here, but, you know,
maybe
very
it's enough
violent
to say it's hardcore, it's all there, and some of it gets really wild very quickly on the web.
Right. It's violent, it's extreme, and this is where boys are looking at this and saying, you know, well, and when you talk to boys of this age, they will say that this is where they're learning about sex. This is where they're getting their ideas. Kids are pretty literal.
What's the impact over, you know, for the rest of their lives of being introduced to sex in such a hardcore way, in such abundance, at their fingertips, right there in the family home?
You know, it's a disturbing question. Obviously, for ethical reasons, you can't conduct sort of quantitative research to find out exactly how this is impacting them, and it's a little bit early to tell. But when you talk to child psychologists, they say it's very disturbing that you're seeing children, boys at the age of 13, 14, addicted to internet pornography, unable to get offline. And if you just think about what it is that they're learning, I mean, there are scenes where you have women crying during sex, images of pain. There's a lot of sadomasochism, a lot of very violent imagery. And this is what they're learning is supposed to be enjoyable. This is what they're learning that women want.
Janet's calling right now from Carlisle, Massachusetts. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi. This is sort of an interesting discussion. For me, a couple days ago, I caught my 12-year-old daughter looking at extraordinarily hardcore porn on the internet, and found out looking in my computer's history that she had been looking at it when she had a friend over. And
One time, Janet, or more than once at 12?
No, I'd actually caught her doing it before. I had put I put controls on so she couldn't do it, but she managed to get around them.
Sure.
They're very tight controls, so we hadn't been able to get into other sites. My husband had taken the controls off, forgotten to put them back on.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is, you know, how do I, as a parent, knowing that she's seen these images, knowing that her friends are seeing these images, first of all, stop her from going over to friends' houses where maybe they don't have these controls? I talked to our principal, and his thing was that when you try to warn parents about this, they all say, well, not my kids. My kids aren't doing it.
Right.
And these are good girls. I mean, I know these girls. They're wonderful.
Janet, let me ask you. There cannot be a parent in this country who's thinking about what's going on, who hasn't worried about this, who isn't worrying about it right now with kids of quite a broad age. What did your daughter say? What do you fear here?
Well, her response was, Mom, all the kids are looking at this. Where do you think I got the name of the site from? And, of course, what I'm fearing is how do I, as a parent, educate her, especially now that she's seen these incredibly hard images, that this is not what lovemaking between people is like.
It's hard to take it back once the image is there. Pamela Paul, please stand by. And Janet, our caller, I want to invite another voice in to help us out here. Marianne Layden is joining us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's co-director of the Sexual Trauma and Psychopathology Program at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a clinical psychotherapist. She treats victims and perpetrators of sexual violence. Janet, we're not throwing your daughter into that category, but Marianne's thought a lot about this. Marianne Layden, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So here's Janet, and you know she's not alone. Millions of families, this is how kids are learning about sex these days.
Absolutely.
What are the implications of, you know, of children learning about sex through internet porn?
Well, it's very troubling. Once we get to the point where every child in the society has seen an image of women being raped and enjoying it, seen an image of adults having sex with children and the children enjoying it, that we know it changes their attitudes, we know it changes their behavior, it increases the speed with which they have sexual intercourse, they start younger, it changes their attitudes toward what is appropriate. There was a study done on children in Australia. These were children who had already acted out sexually, so these were 12-year-old children who were sexually perpetrating against other children. And what they found was in that group of young sexual perpetrators that all of them had been to internet sex sites, and some of them thought that there was no other purpose for the internet than to go to sex sites.
Marianne Layden, let me ask you then. Here's Janet. Her daughter's been there and done it, and so have millions and millions of other kids.
Right.
What can a parent do in that situation to try and kind of not just control the access, and we'll talk about that, maybe that's possible, but to ameliorate the impact, to try and any parent wants to reach out and save the kind of, a more innocent, a more humane sense of sexuality in their children, for their children's sake. How do you do that once they've touched this?
The very first thing you do is you change your internet service provider to a clean ISP. Because you must have someone who blocks at the ISP level, not the software. I don't recommend the software at all. So then you say to your child, the reason I've put this on is because those images hurt you, and I don't want you hurt. I don't want you thinking of sex like this. I think that this is something that will cause a problem for you. And you give a very strong message to the child that this will make a problem in your life. It will send you messages that won't be helpful to you. And then you make sure that you tell other parents that you're doing that, that you don't want your child going to internet sex sites, and that they need to be alerted, the other parents need to be alerted to the fact that their children go. Many parents don't even know how to look at the history on their computer. It's amazing that the children know how to get to internet sex sites more easily than the parents do.
Janet, let me ask you, you've been there. Are you willing? Are you ready to have that conversation with your daughter? Have you had it or tried?
Oh, I've definitely had it. I have to tell you, I am a sexuality educator, so, you know, this is something that I'm very open about. And she and I have talked about sexuality, since she was first aware that she was a girl and there were these other things called boys.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have that conversation. We continue to have that conversation. So it's certainly not something that I'm afraid to talk to her about.
We wish you luck with it. It's a heck of a challenge. Thanks for calling, Janet. Pamela, I hear you there.
Yeah, I just want to jump in and say, you know, another thing is that parents can add a context to it. A 12-year-old is old enough to understand that this is a business, that these people are out to make money, that the women and men in these films were paid to do this just the way prostitutes are paid to have sex, that this is, you know, this is sex completely devoid of emotion, of human relationships, et cetera. And I think it's about really differentiating between what is a positive, natural human interaction sexually and what is a commercialized representation of sex.
But what a world when all that is there and it's scarcely possible to keep it away from the fingertips and eyes of children despite best efforts. I want to turn now to Rob Kerkorian. He's chief of staff in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Massachusetts. The U.S. Attorney in this district, Michael Sullivan, chief of staff to Sullivan. Rob Kerkorian, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking about internet pornography, and of course, there's a vast universe of that out there now. When does porno cross the line to illegality? And when you look at the internet and sex, where are your concerns about prosecutable offenses here?
Well, obviously, anything that involves children or attempts to involve children is one of our highest domestic priorities. And the department continues to focus a lot of resources on child exploitation and internet pornography. And obviously, there's a role for parental involvement here, but it also has become a place where predators can hide behind the relative anonymity of the internet, and they seek to exploit children wherever they can.
So what's the bigger problem here? Porno, children being exploited in porno, or predators reaching out actually trying to, you know, whether they exploit online or they try to turn it into a physical relationship? Where are most of your resources pointed?
Well, obviously it's a combination of all of the above. Certainly we try to get this behavior before it comes to the point where they're actually have the opportunity to act on it. But obviously, once they become involved in surfing the internet, that is the beginning of predatory behavior, and they're seeking to some way come in contact with these children. And so essentially anything from our perspective that deals with child pornography, whether or not there's contact by the individuals viewing the pornography or downloading those images, that is something we aggressively investigate and prosecute. We work closely with the FBI, the United States Postal Inspection Service, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and within the Executive Office of the United States Attorneys throughout the country, U.S. Attorney's Offices have dedicated specially trained and experienced prosecutors to attack this problem.
How do you think you're doing with it? We all saw the headlines this week of the Department of Homeland Security official, 55 years old, thought he was soliciting a 14-year-old girl. It turned out to be a Florida sheriff. How common is it that people doing this get picked up, or are they, you know, are millions of these things going on all the time and undetected, unprosecuted?
Well, certainly we can't detect and prosecute all of the behavior, and like other predatory sex crimes, a very small number of people that actually commit those crimes are ever caught and prosecuted. But that doesn't dissuade us from dedicating whatever resources we can. Here in the District of Massachusetts, in terms of the casework that we've been doing, in the last fiscal year, we had 11 cases involving child exploitation and internet pornography. This year, approximately halfway through the fiscal year, we already have 15 open charged cases involving child exploitation, and all but one of those includes internet pornography issues with children.
Yeah, Rob, what's your sense in the end? Is there a legal, a law enforcement answer to this or something else? What else? What's the answer?
Well, I'm sure like many crimes, the answer is more of a holistic approach. There's certainly a prevention and education component. There is an aggressive law enforcement component, and there is certainly a personal and parental responsibility component. And like anything, it's going to take everyone focusing on the problem, recognizing how severe this problem is and the type of really obscene and predatory people that are out there. And we will continue to do whatever we can. We encourage people to become involved in their children's activity, whether that has to do with the internet or any other aspect of their life. And obviously, to the extent that anyone becomes aware of any information regarding child pornography, internet pornography, or any sort of exploitation of children, to bring that to our attention or the attention of the FBI, the Postal Service, or inspection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Be close to your kids, but it's not easy to be on top of this one. Rob Kerkorian, Chief of Staff in the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Boston. Thanks very much for joining us, Rob.
Thank you, Tom.
Let me take a call from Fairfax, Virginia. Mike is calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, what do you know?
I'm a software engineer, and I was listening to the conversation. I've wrote articles on pornography and addiction before as a kinesiologist. And listening to this, I'm actually in a process right now of building a new chat room with video, voice, and all this stuff. And it's not public. That means nobody can find out about it from Google or Yahoo.
Does that mean, are you saying you're building a porno chat room?
No, not porno chat room. It's a regular chat room.
Yeah.
I got upset with Yahoo because they got sued $10 million for child pornography swapping. And they knew it was happening, and they were okay with it. So they got sued $10 million. So that was like a slap on the wrist for them.
So what's the point? Where are you going with it, Mike?
My point is that you guys have no clue on how bad it is, or the FBI. My site has just been out there, non-public, and I have 16,000 members.
What's happening? Why are they coming to your site if it's not porno?
Because they're addicted to the cam. The cam is the answer. They get on this cam, and they can watch each other, and they can exchange, and they can wave at each other, and they can smile.
So you're saying you've made it possible for voice and video communication, and then immediately it's flooded by pornographic stuff?
Well, it's not pornographic stuff, but you get these kids in there, and then I have to separate the code to make the kids go in one room and the adults in the other room, and the adults can't go in the kids' room, and the kids' rooms can't. But the other sites are not like that. They go in there, and they drop their name. All they do is drop a Hotmail account.
Mm-hmm.
That's MSN.
Mm-hmm.
So they move from a public room that has admins in it to watch their behavior, and they move off into a private little chat with the kids.
And what is it that people have no idea about, as you say?
That exact incident. I talked to the FBI about it. I was like, do you understand what they're doing? He goes, I don't understand what you mean. I go, they're taking a private MSN account.
Mm-hmm.
They go into a chat room. They just drop their name in the MSN. Just do it. Go into any public chat room and drop your Hotmail, like hotgirl64.
And boom, and off you go. And
you have 500 guys PMing you with girls' pictures, pink text, acting like lesbians, the whole thing. And I was blown away by it because I never knew. I'm just, you know, I'm a person that has an idea on it. And then there's this thing that chat sites are doing where they'll get like an ad from Google or anywhere else that says Xbox Live. And when you click on Xbox Live, it opens up six different sites. One, pornography, because they get paid per click.
After another, and off you go, half a second, and you're deep in the ocean. Mike, thanks very much for your call. Marianne Layden, this term internet sex or internet porn addiction came up just now. You do see it as an addiction. I'm not sure Pamela Paul does. As a clinical psychologist, what do you think is going on here?
I think that the internet is a perfect delivery system for an addictive material. It is visual, which means the images come across as pictures. Therefore, they're not seen as opinions. They're seen as events. It's viewed when you're aroused. It's reinforced by the orgasm. People find that when they start to use, they need more and more of it. They need harder and harder kinds of it. They show withdrawal symptoms when they stop using it. All of these are symptoms of addiction. You see the same kind of phenomena that you see in other addictions, such as denial. This isn't really hurting me. Even men that I'm treating that says, this isn't causing me a problem. And I'm saying, you're using it on your job. You know your job has a zero tolerance policy. You're using it at home. You're getting up at night after your wife has gone to bed, and you're using it in the middle of the night. So you've lost sleep. You're not having sex with your actual wife. You're using it in ways that cost money, and you're spending money that you can't afford to spend. all of these things, they're saying, no, it's not really causing me a problem, when in fact it is causing them a problem. Their wife may consider it infidelity. It's threatening their relationship. We know that men who use pornography start to believe that you don't need to restrict it from children, so they're using it at times when children could be exposed to it in their homes.
And again, are you talking, I mean, you deal with real criminal sexual predators. Are you talking at the sort of wild fringes of society here or something else?
No, I'm not. I do deal with some individuals who are predators, but what we found in our own research is about 87% of college students use internet pornography, and we're treating individuals who are coming in into treatment saying other problems. I've got problems in my relationship. They're not connecting it to their internet pornography use. I've got problems in getting my work done at school. I've got problems on my job. And when we start to ask them about the problems, we'll find out that they're spending 10 or 12 hours a week on internet porn sites, that they're doing all of these things that actually are damaging them, but they haven't connected it to. So we see increased premature ejaculation, retarded ejaculation. We see men who no longer can have sex with an actual woman.
Yeah.
We see increases in acceptance of the rape myth among these college students.
Let me put this to Pamela Paul. Pamela, you know, porno has been around forever. I mean, people, human beings, enjoy sex and sexuality. Do you see an addiction emerging here? Do you see these kind of really, you know, sexual difficulties emerging from this superabundance?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, obviously sex has always been around, but sex is very different from pornography. Pornography is the commercial representation of sex, and it's different from art that depicts sexuality. It's different from literature that has sexual scenes in it. So I really think that it's important to make that distinction. I'm not a psychologist. So I cannot say definitively whether it's addictive or not, but I will say this. We tend to think of these dichotomies. You either have, you know, normal people or you have the sexual predators. Mm-hmm. You have people who use regular pornography, and then you have the child pornography users. And I think especially with the internet, those lines are really blurring. So when I talk to men for my book, every single one of them had come across child pornography. And these were not all child porn users. Mm. Before the internet, would they have come across child pornography? Absolutely not.
Victoria is calling right now from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Victoria. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I've kind of grown up in this internet explosion. I've seen this change in people. And I don't know. I can't really say change because I haven't seen the other side of it.
Okay.
But I think it definitely affects our behavior and affects how men view women, how men view women in sexual relationships, and the expectations they have upon women, and that leads into a whole different set of the equality in relationships and how acting these things out. And I definitely, I think, among my peers, I've seen this among friends and guys.
Victoria, how do you see it? You sound, I don't know, late high school or college. I mean, you as you say, you've grown up right in the teeth of this. Mm-hmm. How does it actually show up in your life in ways that you can share with us?
Well, as a college student, I mean, I interned for Planned Parenthood for a little while, and I saw it within the girls coming in there talking about their sexual relationships and how they were suggested to be put in positions that maybe they weren't necessarily thought of on their own, but through education, through sexuality education that their boyfriends are receiving through porn.
So ideas from porn that come right into their personal sexual relationships with young men.
It's definitely affecting on a very individual level. And I think, in a large extent, too, we don't talk about sex in our nation. It's not something we can openly talk about or in our school of abstinence-only education.
Victoria, let me ask you. You've grown up with this. This is your generation dealing with it. Are human beings big enough to kind of absorb this and keep on going? We'll be fine, thank you. Or do you see it as a real problem?
I think it's really an advocate in a healthy direction where it wasn't violence against women, where derogatory porn or hardcore porn weren't main educators or main things of usage. And so I think it has a natural part of society, and it always has.
Mm-hmm.
And it can continue to have a healthy part. But I think we must, like anything, we have to use it in moderation. We have to advocate that as well.
Yep, advocate for it. We've got it. Victoria, thanks for your call. I want to look at the impact on marriages as well here. This is not just something about single people or young people. Cheryl Hepford joins us now from Rockville, Maryland, a divorce attorney, president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Cheryl, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What are you seeing in divorce courts as relates to sex and the internet, Cheryl?
Well, we're seeing the population becoming much more aware of the fact that pornography is readily available, especially as a result of the advent of the high-speed internet. and it's facilitated more and more people utilizing it. And more often than not, when it's being utilized in the marriages, the courts become aware of that and the fact that it's one of many factors that have led to the divorce.
Now, you say more often than not, when there's internet porn in a marriage, courts come to learn about it. I'm skeptical of that. But because it must be in many households that don't end up in divorce court. But do you see it as a factor in divorces?
It is a factor in divorce. What I mean by that is that the significant number of divorces resolve amicably without the need of litigation, but the ones where there are significant difficulties and a failure on the part of the spouses to communicate, and they are litigious and they wind up in court, we're finding that there's more and more references to this type of activity leading to the breakdown of divorce, especially where fault is one of the factors that's being considered by the court when determining benefits of support or division of property.
And computer hard drives, as I understand it, are ending up as evidence in divorce battles. Is that right, Cheryl?
Yes, I think that those who take part in this assume that there's some degree of anonymity, but what they fail to recognize is that their spouses are sometimes more aware of it than they believe, and those spouses are able to access the hard drive even if the spouse that's been online has deleted the information or has tried to delete the information.
So is it your sense that this is just a sort of a club used to beat a spouse in a divorce case, or is it actually breaking up marriages?
Well, I think it's actually a function of a lack of trust that exists in a lot of marriages, and it's the lack of trust that really precipitates the breakdown of the relationship. It's just one of many factors that validates the lack of trust and the fact that there's no communication. Mm.
Cheryl Hepfer, president of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alex is calling from Boston. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Basically, it's just been my experience with a lot of sort of events where this topic came up, like with Take Back the Night events, rally events, or pro-women sort of anti-rape events, is that a lot of students I've spoken to who, like, were able to do this without getting caught by their parents, is that they generally sort of come to their own conclusion that what's being depicted here is not really very real or necessarily healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I can give one case example of like a friend of mine who actually has over 40 gigs of porn. When I first met him, I was like, "Why? How can you have over 40 gigs of porn?
That is a lot.
And like, have a normal functioning life." But I mean, this is a law student. And he's a very heavily involved law student, and he actually doesn't even approach this like regular porn anymore. Basically, he doesn't even use it to sexually satisfy himself at all.
What is it then?
He basically just collects it for, like, to follow the awards for, like, with porn and, like, to follow developments of the porn stars and everything like that.
Alex, stick with us for a second here. Pamela Paul, here's the argument that, you know, humans are incredibly adaptable. Young people figure out that this is gross, it's not real, and they kind of compartmentalize and maybe they can deal with it. What do you say? What have you found?
You know, every once in a while you do come across a parent who says, you know, my child, you know, is mature enough, smart enough, or, you know, a teenager who says, look, I know this stuff isn't real. And, you know, maybe there are some that are mature enough and able to understand, to distinguish between fantasy and reality, between corporate business sex and real sexuality, but not all, not all by far. And I would say the vast majority, you know, there's also a huge level of denial and rationalization. You know, when you talk to men, again, most of the guys I talked to for my book, pro-porn, guys who loved pornography, and they weren't out to demonize it. And yet they admitted that there had been these negative implications on their lives. There were men who said, for example, that they considered themselves purely casual users, but that they had started to try to restrict their own use because they were using it too much. And so they made themselves little, you know, plans like, I'm not going to use it on the weekend anymore, or no using it after 11 o'clock at night. These were not people that considered themselves addicts. They didn't have a problem with porn. So this guy that the caller is talking about, his friend, you know, he may consider himself to have no problem. But do we know that he's functioning sexually, you know, well in relationships? Do we know exactly, you know, what's going on with him? Does he is he aware of it? I mean, there's a lack of self-awareness often on the part of the user as to how it's affecting them.
Alex, do you think your friend has no problem?
Well, I mean, like, I've actually talked to him a lot about that because, like, I've never met someone who had, like, over 40 gigs of porn. And actually, yeah, I mean, find out he's in a very healthy relationship right now that he's actually been able to keep for more than a year. And basically, at the same time, he does have a lot of sort of stuff, but he's able to keep everything sort of covered and everything like that.
Oh, so, boy.
And does she know about it?
Does she know about his 40 gigs?
Yeah, she does.
She's all right with it?
Yeah, I mean, he basically shares it like almost, I would say, a connoisseur or whatever, because he's just saying, oh yes, in this porn we have the first usage of this, or this porn was noted for its like.
So he's become a kind of scholar of the porn realm.
Basically. And so he's not even using it as much for sort of sexual release.
Right, we got it, Alex. Thanks for the report, Pamela. Let me bring in another call here because our time's running down. Chris is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi.
What do you know, Chris?
Well, I am a sexual compulsive, so, and it deals with internet pornography. And I wanted to bring up something that none of you guys have talked about. There are groups based on 12-step programs that are available for people like me who know that they are powerless over this. They can go to and try to get help.
So you say, hi, I'm Chris, and I'm an internet porn addict.
Yeah.
And then what? How do you get out of it?
Well, you don't. I mean, you're going to have to live with it the rest of your life. But you realize that you're powerless over it, that you can't deal with it, and you ask your higher power to help you with it.
Chris, why is it a problem for you?
Why is it a problem for me? Because I can't resist the urge to go online and surf the sites.
Has it disrupted your life or your mental health?
Very much so. Very much so. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I didn't realize how much it had. You talked about compartmentalizing earlier, and I had done that completely. Let me give you a website, if I may. Can I?
Yes.
Okay.
I hope.
Well, it's...
Make it clean.
Yeah, it is. Sexual Compulsions Anonymous, SCA. The website is sca-recovery.org. And that is the website of the 12-step program I am in.
Got it. We got it. And there may be an answer for some people. Chris, thank you for calling. I want to bring one more voice in. Joining us from San Francisco is Perry Aftab, security, privacy, and cyberspace lawyer, executive director of WiredSafety.org, an online safety and educational program. Perry, thanks for being with us.
I appreciate being asked.
So here we are. It's out there. Everybody knows it's out there. It can touch, does touch an awful lot of people, almost everybody at some point, it seems, these days. Chris says he's found, you know, a sort of self-help program. What about for families, for people who feel, you know, caught in a tar baby here? What do they do about it?
Well, the easy answer to this is filtering software. Most of the products work very well, and most families should be using them. If you use them and you set them, they are very, very good at blocking out porn. In our studies, they blocked out between 95 and 100% of the porn that comes in, either as attachments or websites.
And does that keep kids from getting to it, or they just do it at the neighbor's house then?
Well, they may be doing it at the neighbor's house, but you need to talk to your kids. So you'll stop it from coming in on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new cell phone service that Disney has that launches in June that allows the kids only to access Disney-approved content from their own server, so they don't have full internet access.
But does that mean they're just stuck in a world? Are they stuck in a world of Mickey Mouse and make believe, or can they, you know, do real research online? Let's say
they can't do. This is on their cell phones. They don't need to do real research.
I see.
They
on their cell
check
phones.
Weather and news, and the rest is teen content and family content for Disney, not necessarily Mickey Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, you have to sit down and talk to your kids. They're encountering a lot of things that none of us did when we were growing up. When the worst we saw was somebody's Playboy magazine hidden under the mattress. Now our kids are exposed to bestiality and S&M, pornography, things that most adults shouldn't see, much less our children. So
Perry,
talk to them. They need to know to come to you when things go wrong so you can set the record straight.
Let me ask you, I mean, you know, we're not here with torches to sort of burn down the realm of sexuality, but you want to keep it healthy. You want a healthy society. Is there a national answer to this, or does it really depend on one family at a time?
Well, when you talk about the Internet, you can't think nationwide. You have to think worldwide because that's how it works.
Okay, worldwide then.
And in the United States, we have the Constitution, which precludes our government from putting in legislation to control the Internet or any other medium unless the work is obscene. And so that's a problem.
But it is obscene. So much of it is obscene. Couldn't that be somehow restricted? It was restricted in the old days in the magazine stands, plastic covers, and age limits.
But plastic covers and age limits, you had somebody on the ground who you could find. You could find the local 7-Eleven dealer or someone else on the ground. When on the Internet, it's between the website that may be located in Thailand or the Caribbean or some other place that doesn't technically ship into the United States. It's just viewable from the United States from a user. So legislatively, it's very difficult. The .XXX, which was proposed and initially approved by ICANN, is a way to make it easier to block them, and it actually has provisions within it to clean up anything outside of .XXX from not the sexual content, but at least to be able to spot them.
What's happening with that? That would be an alternative to .com, .XXX. Is it coming? Could we push all of this there and then block it off?
ICANN and the White House, I think, didn't really understand what it was and asked them to put a hold on it. I expect it to be approved over the next month, so it will be an alternative. Under the laws in the United States, we can't make it mandatory, but if we make it so that adults who want to see it will prefer to go there because they won't be stealing their credit card information or committing fraud with their identities, then most will go there, and then it's a lot easier for us to deal with.
Perry Aftab, Executive Director at WiredSafety.org, thanks a lot for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Pamela Paul, take us home here. We just got 2 or 3 minutes. And I wonder, at the end of the day, how should we absorb this? I mean, it's kind of an overwhelming impact of this technology. You don't have to be a Puritan to be worried about it. Is there any way we come out the other end of this with our sexuality healthy and intact?
I think actually the image that is peddled by pornographers of sexuality is a lot more negative than the reality of sex. And it's become ironic that we have this mindset in this country that if you're pro-sex, then you have to be in favor of pornography. Or if you're progressive and open-minded, you have to be in favor of pornography. Mm. A lot of what you see in pornography is very repressive, very regressive, reactionary views of sex as something dirty, as something violent, as something unpleasant, certainly something demeaning both to men and to women. And I think that educating people and expanding the knowledge of, first of all, those ideas, the ideas of sexuality that pornography perpetrates, but also the way in which it affects people's lives and people being more open, like your caller earlier who said that, you know, he is addicted and that he did compartmentalize it. Women that I talked to were afraid to speak out, afraid to tell their boyfriends or their husbands that they had a problem with pornography because they were afraid of being shut down by the men saying, you know, it's just a guy thing, or everyone is okay with porn, or what's wrong with you? Women, wives who discover that, a 38-year-old wife that her husband is looking online at, 18-year-old girls, 19-year-old girls, how is she supposed to feel? And she feels, very often betrayed, feels that there's been a breach of trust, as the matrimonial lawyer pointed out earlier.
Right.
And yet we have a mindset in this country that her point of view is not legitimate.
And a kind of sexual callousness that can come in here. If you look decades out, do you think society is going to grow up, say, we can deal with this, or we're going to have to put controls on this? The Internet's still pretty new. One day, will we restrict this or just get used to it?
Well, there are certain restrictions that can be put into place without threatening the Constitution. As your last guest pointed out, Miller versus California, the last Supreme Court decision dates to 1973, obviously before the Internet, and it's all about the local community. So I think perhaps the law hasn't moved forward to address the reality of the Internet. But I think what has to happen, in a certain way, is what happened with cigarettes. Smoking used to be considered very glamorous. It was promoted on film. You can go see Thank You for Smoking and learn all about that. We need to do the same thing with pornography, where people understand the harm caused by pornography, where people make individual decisions that they're not going to use pornography.
Pamela Paul, you've been a great guide, and we're very grateful to you for being with us. Your book is Pornified: How Pornography is Transforming Our Lives, Our Relationships, and Our Families. Pam, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.